Okay,
well, let's see what's firmly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
in the exact same spot both times.
But
I'm sorry, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Right, Lisa,
are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and welcome to edition 443 of Strange Days Indeed. This week, the 2nd in June 2007, our editorial contributor, Dave Verlott, former SDI host and our space correspondent Michael J. Woods, and researcher and author of UFOs and the Death of Marilyn Monroe, Dr. Donald Burleson, will join us from his home in Roswell, New Mexico. These are Strange Days Indeed. Neil Armstrong was recently on Fox TV's Neil Cavuto program, and something during the course of that program flustered him, and he ended up throwing something totally unexpected at Cavuto just as Cavuto was wrapping the program up. Here's how it sounded as recorded using the microphone on a video camera.
Listen, we just about could have said, look, we see a UFO out the window going along with us. You know what would have happened? The public would have gone crazy. Yeah. But we were smart enough to say, where is the upper stage rocket? We think we might be looking at that out the window.
Indeed.
Okay, thanks a lot, Neil. I appreciate talking to you always.
Always.
Now, what's interesting about that is that Buzz Aldrin has consistently switched back and forth between denying that the Apollo 11 crew saw anything unusual outside their command module and admitting that they saw something inexplicable. Here's what Buzz Aldrin told a documentary crew a couple of years ago.
There is something out there that was close enough to be observed, and what could it be? Mike decided he thought he could see it in the telescope, and he was able to do that, and when it was in one position, that it had a series of ellipses.
But when you made it real sharp, it was sort of L-shaped.
That didn't tell us very much. Obviously, the three of us were not going to blurt out, hey, Houston, we got something moving alongside of us, and we don't know what it is. You know, can you tell us what it is? We weren't about to do that, because we know that those transmissions would be heard by all sorts of people, and who knows what somebody would have demanded that we turn back because of aliens or whatever the reason is. So we didn't do that, but we did decide, we just cautiously asked Houston, how far away was the S-4B?
Do you have any idea where the S-4B is with respect to us?
Semi.
Apollo 11, Houston, the S-4B is about 6,000 nautical miles from you now, over.
A few moments later, well, they came back and said something like it was 6,000 miles away because of the maneuver. So we really didn't think we were looking at something that far away. So we decided that after a while of watching it, it was time to go to sleep and not to talk about it anymore until we came back in debriefing.
And then, of course, several times since, he's turned around and denied that they saw anything. So, Buzz and Neil, what's the word? You did or you didn't see an unidentified on the way to the moon?
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Verlott.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list entitled, What Hummingbirds Can Teach Us of UFOs. And I suspect that the person who began the thread may have chosen this method to show the various ways people accept or do not accept reported sightings of UFOs. James Horrock delights us with his post by telling us that something happened in the Amazon basin to make hummingbirds migrate north, and how he began seeing new versions of the tiny bird. But there is one that he has seen that has antenna. What? A bird with antenna? Is this a hitchhiker that climbed aboard a space shuttle? Perhaps there are alien hummingbirds flitting around in outer space that come to our planet in search of the elusive strawberry ice cream plant. Are these little green hummingbirds? Quick, grab a net and let's catch one of these creatures so we can study it. With luck, and under the correct conditions, perhaps we can make it talk. Tell us what it's doing here. Maybe they are just the scouts for a huge army set to invade our poor planet and make off with all the nectar from our plants. Maybe that something that happened in the Amazon basin was our valiant soldiers trying to defend us against the impending invasion, and the hummingbird with the antenna are just the survivors of the battle that fled north. Damn, it's fun having a vivid imagination, isn't it? It did not take long, however, for the whole story about the hummingbird that has antenna on its head to come out as being a species of moth called, ready for this, the hummingbird moth. Matter of fact, it is better known as a type of hawk moth called the hummingbird hawk moth, and it behaves almost identically to a real hummingbird. It hovers in place and beats its wings so quickly that it produces a humming sound. It has a large insect proboscis that it extends to feed from flowers, and unlike regular moths, it flies during the day and even flies at times in rain. Many people on the UFO updates list produce several different links to pictures of the hummingbird moth, and many of those pictures really do look like a bona fide hummingbird. Now, instead of James Horrock accepting this explanation of his strange sighting, he insists that what he saw was actually a real hummingbird with antenna, because he says that he noticed the creature had feathers. So perhaps we're once again back to the impending invasion of our planet by alien hummingbirds. The entire thread is very interesting because it shows me as a ufologist exactly how we treat reports of UFO sightings. A UFO sighting will be reported, and some ufologists will accept without question that the report is valid and factual, and make their decision quickly that what was sighted was a bona fide UFO. Other ufologists will start to do some digging into what has been reported, with the objective being to either prove or disprove the claim by an individual as to what they saw, and present their findings to allow the rest of us to either investigate further, if there's still some question, or to put the sighting to rest as being an identified flying object. What also came out in some of the posts about the strange hummingbird was how, even after enough evidence was brought forward to show the sighting as being simply a mistake, the original poster immediately states that he is right, and everyone else is wrong because he knows what he saw. This places the onus on the community to either accept the word of the original poster as being truth and agreeing that there must be some kind of new species of hummingbird, or having to maintain that the person is wrong and they didn't see what they thought they saw. Now, I'm no expert on birds or on moths, and when someone tells me they've seen a hummingbird that has antenna, I'll listen to their story. I won't agree, I won't disagree. When several people come forward and show evidence of what could easily be mistaken as a hummingbird with antenna, I then put the onus back on the original person. And I say, show me the proof that you saw what you saw was a hummingbird, and I'll believe you. But right now, it would appear that you were mistaken in what you saw, and until you can prove your claim, I have to accept the body of evidence already presented. As of right now, I don't believe we're going to be invaded by alien hummingbirds, but I am going to hide my strawberry ice cream, just in case. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
Yeah, James Horak will be absolutely thrilled to hear your take from this program. Although he was very adamant that what he saw was not an insect.
Yes, yes.
And he said that he made images of what he saw, but hasn't, I don't think, made those images available.
I don't believe he has either.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see them if he ever does make them available, because, to be blunt, like, even if you look at this creature from the various pictures that are on the web, it's very difficult to tell whether, yeah, it has feathers or what have you. You can't tell from pictures what it has on its body.
Mm-hmm.
I was blown away when I saw the pictures. It was like, whoa, that's a hummingbird with that tat on its head.
I have to be very honest and say I didn't go and look at those images. Lack of time, you know, life, the universe and everything and the list and editing this podcast. It's fascinating, actually, that something would look like a hummingbird. What would be the purpose of that, I wonder?
I'm not sure, but again, like the same thing. It also does exactly the same things that a hummingbird does. It goes after plants, flitting around in front of a plant and basically feeding off it. It makes itself look like a hummingbird so it doesn't get attacked by other insects and birds, probably.
Yeah.
That would love to have it as a nice little lunch. The interesting thing as well is when James originally posted about it, he said that the back of it sort of looked like its tail feathers were curled up. And that's exactly what the hawk moth looks like. It looks like a curled up tail almost.
Yeah, well, that's a dead giveaway then, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was good in the sense of how any kind of reported sighting can come out, and people immediately make their decisions one way or the other. And while others kind of sit back and say, okay, well, let's take a look at this and see what's what, and others go about actively investigating and saying, hold on here, guy, here's what we think you saw.
Yeah, well, Don Ledger was a little irritated after he posted his sighting reports of objects over on the east coast of Canada that nobody had even bothered to respond or discuss those reports and were much too interested in talking about the potential discovery of water on Mars and hummingbird moths.
It's the old story of different things. But again, like in this situation, I bet there's some investigation going on within the community. And others are basically sitting back and saying, okay, well, let's see what comes out about this first before I make any kind of an opinion.
Yes, keyboard ufologists.
Yeah.
Which is a dead steal from armchair ufologists. Yeah.
The rovers finding puddles.
We'll see what Woodsy has to say about that.
It's going to be good. I could imagine these little rovers running around Mars and sort of jumping in puddles.
And I hope they have their Wellington boots on or their rubber boots.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dave Furlong, another good take. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week.
For sure.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm the urban spaceman, baby. I've got speed. I've got everything I need.
J. Woods has been involved with this program for several hundred years now. He used to sit in the co-host chair of Strange Days Indeed. He usually sits in the senior news editor's seat at City TV, which is in downtown Toronto. He joins us on the line from his home, outside of which is parked a white sunbird pervertible, with the license plate UFO guy. Hello, Michael J. Woods.
Hello, Errol. Bruce and Matt, how are you, sir?
Moderate, as Chris Rutkowski says.
Well, that's a way to be. a moderate moderator is always to be accepted.
Yes, and my mother prefers I'm like that.
Well, that's the way to do it, then. You're going to keep Mama happy.
Yes. You have been, of late, being our spaced correspondent.
Yes, I seem to have spaced out a little bit.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of people that would agree with that. Yes, I've been following the space program. There's been a few interesting little burbles, and as well, of course, as always, I lurk on the UFO updates list, mainly because you never know when a good eye-scratching, hair-pulling match will get underway between two Titanic egos, and I always like to watch that kind of thing.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to post this because I know what's going to happen is the way I work.
Well, exactly, and I pay to watch UFC. What can I say? You know, I like a good fight. From my point of view, there's been a few interesting things. Now, the number one thing that in the last little while, as far as I'm concerned, was a short-lived yet extremely intense rush, one that sucked in some very intelligent people and some real dumb ones, me, for one. And this was the claim that the rover Opportunity, the little rover that keeps on going, like the Energizer Bunny, on Mars had taken photos of puddles of liquid water.
Yeah.
About the only thing that could have gotten better was if they'd gotten a photo of an alien life form hopping across the center of the camera range. I mean, you know, that could only be the topper. Of course, it wasn't. The whole story about the puddles begins with the New Scientist website that first posted this photo and the claims of the puddles. I guess within seconds, the same on UFO updates list, people began questioning it. And they pretty quickly determined that the photos were actually photos of a slope and being looked at with the wrong perspective, and there was no way there could be standing water there because we're actually talking about water standing on the side of a hill.
Yep.
That doesn't work, homie.
No.
Even on Mars with its slightly lighter gravity. This is one of those opportunities for scientists to learn the lesson that I like to teach new people in the newsroom when they're trying to decide which part of the politician or whomever's babble they're going to create a clip from. And I always tell them, context is all. And if you're looking at photos of Mars, better make sure you know where it came from on Mars before you start honing in on the little teeny tiny details.
And which way is up?
Yeah, that helps too. Even on Mars, water runs downhill. So do other things, and we'll get there. Now, in a related topic, though, guess what scientists have come to the conclusion after, you know, close to, 3 years of the rovers providing proof after proof after proof?
I don't know. What, Mike Woods?
They now think that Mars had huge oceans.
Really?
Unbelievable, eh?
Inconceivable. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, they said that the once flat shorelines were disfigured by a massive toppling over of the planet. The warping of the Martian rock has hidden clear evidence of the oceans, which in any case have been gone for at least 2 billion years. I've always had a problem with that one.
Yeah.
My problem being, of course, is that how does a planet that gets planet-wide dust storms that last a year still retain sharply defined geological features?
That's a damn good question.
Like riverbeds,
yeah.
Okay? And I've always felt, in point in fact, that Graham Hancock, in his The Mars Mystery, had a pretty good hypothesis that, in fact, Mars lost its oceans only about 12,000 years ago.
When it got hit by an asteroid.
Precisely. Now, Here's something that's interesting. Presented on May 23rd to the American Geophysical Union, two University of Santa Barbara scientists presented new findings that suggested that the last major die-off of the megafauna in North America, we're talking like the great elk and the mastodon, wasn't, and the latest trendiest, because trendiest theory from that cluster of pseudoscientists that say everything that bad happens on Earth must be by us, humans. The prevalent theory had been that we were such incredibly coordinated hunters, we managed to hunt all the megafauna to extinction. Okay, well, these two presented evidence at the American Geophysical Union's annual meeting that, in fact, 13,000 years ago, a large extraterrestrial rock walloped into the continent. Wildfires from the impact took care of the megafauna. And that time frame, 13,000 years ago, ties in very nicely with Graham Hancock's Mars mystery theory on what killed Mars, which was about 13,000 years ago.
Isn't that an interesting coincidence?
Now, so there's an interesting coincidence for you to all think about there. And if you believe in synchronicity, then of course there is no coincidence.
Exactly. So does this fit in with the theory that we are the Martians who abandoned Mars and came here?
I don't know. You could make an argument when you consider some of the post-flood legends that float around, or myth or stories, however you want to put it, that float around from that time. Mayans with their Olmec predecessors and blah, 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 you know, the emergence of Ketel Hayuk in the Turkish Valley, which was the first city that emerged with people who had skills that hadn't developed in any other location that we've ever been able to find. They just suddenly popped up there with these skills. You look at questions like that, you got to start wondering.
Yes, indeed.
Here's another leading us back to the greatest slam your head against the wall mystery, the whole Atlantis myth.
Yeah, and what wiped out Atlantis? And where was Atlantis? And was Atlantis wiped out, or is it sitting under the South Pole?
Or was Atlantis Mars?
Well, yes.
Was Atlantis Mars? And when it got hit, did they come here and tell the guys that were still scratching and picking? Who knows?
That might account for the missing links between us and the original inhabitants of this planet.
Yes, because as much as the evolution theory likes to talk about those nice, clean, linear descendants, getting the actual physical fossils to back up those stories has always proved to be rather a large headache.
And I think will continue to be so.
Personally, there's a lot of planet that would have to be dug up before you're going to find it all.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of plain old flukery involved in specimens surviving. But I do find it interesting that while we've lost the puddles on Mars, we've gained oceans. That's pretty good. Two shores and everything, too, eh? The one dubbed the Arabia Ocean would have contained 2 to 3 times the volume of water that is in the ice that covers Antarctica, and that's quite a bit. You know that, of course, there's always been this dichotomy with Mars and the surface of it, that one half of it is 2 kilometers higher than the other half of the planet. So they're postulating that the evidence of the oceans was hid when the planet toppled and that whole thing went on. But I've never heard a good explanation from science on that one either. What made it lose half a planet down 2 kilometers deep?
Well, that's maybe where the ocean bed was, 2 kilometers down. Maybe it was just an enormous ocean with one continent around it.
A single continent. I like it. Pangaea. Now, there was one thing that crossed my desk in my other life as veteran news writer at City TV. Now, as you might imagine, you work in a major media center, and you are going to see an awful lot of press releases. You'll see press releases for just about everything known to man, and, of course, a lot of things that weren't known to man, and some things that would be better off if no one knew about them at all. But I got one here that crossed my desk, and boy, did my eyebrows go up. Because it seems that, appropriately enough, on July the 4th, Jesse Marcel Jr. is going to release his bio, including everything about Roswell that you were afraid to ask, titled The Roswell Legacy. Some book publisher is going to do me out of $39.95, because I suspect I'll be picking this one up right quick. I've always wondered at how people could just glibly swallow the official Roswell as weather balloon debris and not take the half step and go, and the intelligence officer at the only atomic bomb equipped base in the U.S. was so dumb he didn't recognize weather balloon / radar target debris. So Jesse Marcel Sr. was a pretty on-the-ball type of soldier, as far as I can see. Otherwise, you just don't become the intelligence officer at that type of base.
No.
And not in those post-war paranoia times.
Mm-hmm.
His son isn't exactly a loser by any definition. It's actually Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr., an Air Force Reserve colonel. Yeah, this guy is like the complete person. Doctor, pilot, reserve officer, pretty upstanding citizen. And this is 2 generations. And I don't care how old you get. I remember things when I was 10 and 13 years old, which was how old he was, somewhere in that age span when his father showed him the debris. And he's had a lifetime to reflect on it.
Yep. Coming up on this program is Dr. Don Burleson, who has just published a book on UFOs and the death of Marilyn Monroe, which is a fascinating listen, I have to tell you. And you might lend that interview your ears coming up in a few minutes.
I must confess, I have yet to miss, unlike Strange Days Indeed on radio, I have yet to miss a webcast.
Like that.
It is such a totally perfect medium for this topic. It allows the full development of ideas. So often you lose your train of thought because you have to break for a commercial, break for a station idea, whatever. In this format, the ideas can flow out and they can spawn off and you don't derail. You may sidetrack, but at least you're not being derailed by interruptions. And it makes for some fascinating listening. I mean, just...
Yeah, indeed.
Just so there's something else to put on my to-do list.
Yeah. As I say, coming up in a few minutes, Donald Burleson.
And there's linkage.
Absolutely.
Well, I look forward to that. With it only being a couple of minutes, I shall have to run and quickly get myself another cold can of soda drink and a little something to dilute it, preferably the extract of molasses, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah, from the bottom of some kind of wooden barrel, as I recall.
Yes, first created by those clever people on the island. Other than that, Errol, I'm happy to report that once I'm finished listening to the upcoming interview, I'm off to the Apocalypse Now, Armageddon Tired of Waiting for It, retreat up north.
Ah!
I'll be taking Bella, the Wonder Hound, with me and opening up the manor once again for another wonderful season.
Well, that's just jolly lovely. How long are you going up there for?
I'll be up there for about a week, and nice. So there's at least 1 week where the city is relatively safe, and I've even got time off from misinforming the public. So it's,
and you'll be able to lay on your back on the dock and look at the stars and go, what is that zigzagging? Oh, that has to be Venus.
Yes, it has to be. It'll be, no doubt, swamp gas rising from an area that doesn't have swamps.
Yeah. Mike Woods, have yourself a fine vacation.
I will, and I thank you, and take care, sir.
And as always, thank you for another wonderful contribution to Strange Days Indeed.
Yes, well, keep your eyes up, sir.
Goodbye, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker, television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe.
Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Burleson is the MUFON State Director for New Mexico, and he lives down there in the heart of New Mexico and probably in a town that absolutely everybody on the planet is familiar with, in the city of Roswell. And I shouldn't call it a town because it's much larger than a town, and having been down there and experienced it myself, I love Roswell. Don Burleson has written a book, UFOs and the Murder of Marilyn Monroe. And a fascinating topic. Over the years, I have come across references to the possibility that Marilyn Monroe knew something about UFOs. So I figured, well, the book is out there. Don Burleson is down there in Roswell. So let's head down to Roswell, New Mexico, and say hi to Don Burleson. Hi, Don Burleson.
Hello.
Warm down there, I guess, with the summer and all in the high desert.
Oh, yes, yes. We had about 92 degrees today. It's beginning to cool off a little now. The sun is going down. It's not as warm as it could be for this time of the year. You know, we've had over 100 degrees sometimes by mid-June. So this is not too bad.
I know what it's like in the beginning of July, having been down there for the 50th anniversary.
Right, and of course now we're going into the 60th anniversary celebration in just a few weeks.
I had Dennis Balthaser on here a couple of weeks ago, and
right.
He was filling us in on what was going to be happening down there. Boy, there is a lot of stuff going on down there this July.
Oh, yeah, we've got a lot of speakers coming in, a lot of activities planned. The city is running the festival this year, and it's probably going to be the biggest festival we've ever had. I'm actually doing a talk myself based on my book, UFOs and the Murder of Marilyn Monroe, doing that on July 5th at the Civic Center, and looking forward to it.
That falls right in the middle of our week or so at the cottage, which I'm looking forward to with much anticipation. I have to tell you, as I am in reading your book, as I said earlier in the introduction, I have heard hints of Marilyn Monroe knowing about what had transpired with the Kennedys and their knowledge of UFOs. So perhaps you can maybe start from the beginning and tell us how you got interested in this case.
Yeah, well, there had been, as you say, intimations for quite some time that Marilyn's death was somehow connected to this whole problem of secrecy, and in particular, things that she may well have gleaned from the Kennedys about some UFO event, either the UFO event in Roswell or some similar event. If you want to go kind of anterior to that a little further back, it started being speculated very soon after Marilyn's death on August 4th, 1962, that it wasn't suicide. Basically, there was something pretty fishy about the way she died, and it was actually quite a while before the UFO connection started knitting itself together. Primarily, the way that started, there was a CIA document that surfaced sometime in the early 1990s. We're not really quite sure who exactly did the Freedom of Information Act request and brought it forward. We do know that the Milo Spiriglio Detective Agency in California at one point had the document. Basically, it's a CIA document dated August 3rd, 1962, the day before Marilyn died. Later, as we get into this, I can even read you the salient points in it. But basically, it talks about wiretap transcripts. It talks about the fact that some government agencies were nervous because Marilyn was keeping a diary, the now famous Little Red Diary of Secrets, containing heaven only knows what that she had been told by Jack Kennedy and by Robert Kennedy, with both of whom, you know, she had affairs. That document circulated around for quite a while. It got to be well enough known. UFO Magazine, for example, did a special on it, and it got to be well enough known that it really did kind of cause an avalanche of speculation about exactly, you know, what might have gone down. I picked up on the document sometime during the 1990s. I can't remember exactly when I first saw it. And I started doing some research on it, looking at things like the routing data and things like that. And I actually discovered some new evidence having to do with that document. And the more I looked at it, the more there was evidence actually coming from other sources. For example, I have also some very interesting FBI documentation that basically places Bobby Kennedy pretty much at the scene the night Marilyn died. I should mention, actually, that a fellow who lives in New Hampshire by the name of Donald Wolfe wrote an excellent book called The Last Days of Marilyn Monroe. He actually did a great deal of footwork on just the general subject of her death, pretty much placing the Kennedys smack in the middle of it. He did not and still does not make the UFO connection. Interestingly, he has the Marilyn CIA document actually reproduced as an appendix in the back of the book, but he does not say anything about the line in that document that, for most of us, strongly suggests the connection with the UFO secrecy matter. But that document, of course, has figured very centrally in the whole thing. And again, I'll tell you a little bit later what new evidence I found connected to that document. But actually, the document, as most of these things tend to go, of course, the document has not been without controversy. There are people who have said, for example, that they doubt whether the document is authentically a CIA piece. Some people have said maybe it's bogus, maybe it's a hoax. It isn't, as it turns out. The interesting thing that happened to me was that I actually sort of maneuvered the CIA into authenticating the documents themselves. It had actually been authenticated by some other people. There was a documents expert at NSA, the National Security Agency, that validated the document. Of course, other document experts have looked at it. But what I did was I turned in a couple of Freedom of Information Act requests to the CIA, asking for the wiretap transcripts on Marilyn's two telephones. There's a certain right way of doing that. You know, when you turn in a FOIA request, you have to sort of show them that they're not dealing with an amateur. You know, you have to basically show them that you know what you're doing that you know how to turn in a request like that. So, of course, I had a very, very detailed request. I had her telephone numbers, and one phone was the pink phone, one phone was the white phone. Don't mess with me. I know about these phones.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I put in a request for those wiretap transcripts, figuring that if I could, by some remote chance, actually get them, they'd have to be spectacular for reasons that I'll explain a little later. I also put in a request at the same time for her diary, because there's been quite a bit of speculation to the effect that the diary, which disappeared soon after her death, ended up with them, the CIA. When the requisite time had gone by, both of these requests were answered in the negative. They said basically the kind of boilerplate language thing that you usually get from them. They said, we don't have any documents responded to your request. So, of course, I filed an appeal. And when I filed the appeal on the wiretap transcript request, appended the famous Marilyn Monroe CIA document. And I said, how can you tell me that there aren't any wiretap transcripts when, in fact, your own document here says that you had her under surveillance, that the FBI had her under surveillance, that you guys were sharing files. And I know that a fine organization like the Central Intelligence Agency must keep records. So you guys have to have some wiretap transcripts. I think somebody's overlooked something here. And I appended that document as supporting evidence to legitimize my having filed an appeal of that kind. Well, the funny thing was, they accepted the appeal. The CIA actually sent me a letter accepting the appeal. The whole matter went to the agency release panel, which is the top people of the CIA. They're the ones who decide whether to release something or not. And they don't talk about anything unless there is something to release. Their job is to decide whether to release it. So if it goes to the agency release panel, basically they've already admitted that they have something. They're just debating whether to give it to you or not, which, of course, they don't really have to do.
Right.
And in the end, of course, basically George Tenet, you know, who was head of the CIA at the time, I can just sort of imagine him saying, hey, listen, you know, don't give this jerk anything. You know, he's been giving us a really, really bad time about this whole Marilyn Monroe thing. And so they turned the appeal down. But see, the important point is, by accepting that appeal, they authenticated the document, because the appeal was based on the document, and essentially it's against agency policy to accept an appeal to a FOIA request based on something not recognized as an authentic CIA document, or a document that is what one says it is. So the CIA basically admitted, yes, it's our document, by just doing that. The fact that they didn't release anything, of course, didn't surprise me at all. And you have to be aware, when you're a UFO investigator, that when you turn in a FOIA request, you're almost certainly not going to get the material that you're requesting. You're not going to get the documents released. You're not going to get what you're asking for. But what you can sometimes expect is very interesting responses. And I think authentication of that document is about as interesting as it gets.
And it also suggests that they have the diary, too, yes? Because they accepted your appeal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically, the procedure is you decide whether to release something. If you don't have it, you don't decide whether to release it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it pretty much authenticates also, yeah, that they have the diary. The diary actually disappeared out of the safe in the Los Angeles County Coroner's office on the Monday night after Marilyn's death. She died on a Saturday night. On Monday, the diary was locked up in the safe. The next morning when the safe was opened, the diary was gone. And pretty much the rumor has been ever since that the CIA had it. And I think, yeah, this goes a long way toward, in fact, establishing that.
So who would have had access is the question.
Well, actually,
the Saturday
only one had
Monday.
Access to the safe were the coroner and the medical examiner. There were a few top people like that that had access to that safe, but only two or three. Basically, the Los Angeles County coroner at the time was kind of a government toady who pretty much just stuck up for the Kennedys and took his marching orders from the visiting officials and otherwise kept his mouth shut. I'm sure that if they said, open the safe, we want the diary, he would have done that.
Yes. I wonder if anybody had read it prior to that being
taken.
Yes,
actually, several people looked in the diary before its disappearance. Robert Slater, who was a close friend of Marilyn's, had looked through it. We don't have anything on record from him saying actually exactly what he saw, except that she had a tendency to talk about political things that she had basically heard the Kennedys talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, that included a lot of topical things like the trouble with Cuba, Jack Kennedy's plan to assassinate Castro, which, of course, was actually in the works at one point. He was going to hire some mafia-type people to just go down and kill him, you know. And Glazer actually said, yeah, he had actually kind of quickly, kind of summarily flipped through the diary at one point and had seen some things like that in it. The point, really, though, isn't entirely whether the diary actually talks about the UFO secrecy thing that she had gotten from Jack Kennedy. The point is that, obviously, some government agencies like the CIA were very nervous that it might.
Yeah.
That it might say those things. I can actually read you a passage from the CIA document.
Love to hear it. Yes, please.
Essentially, it talks about wiretaps. It says, wiretap of telephone conversation between reporter Dorothy Kilgallen and her close friend Howard Rosberg. A, from wiretap of telephone conversation of Marilyn Monroe and Attorney General Robert Kennedy. B, appraisal of content, and the appraisal is actually redacted. And then the body of the document actually goes on to read like this. Remember, this is wiretap transcripts of Dorothy Kilgallen. Rosberg discussed the apparent comeback of subject, that's Marilyn, with Kilgallen and breakup with the Kennedys. Rosberg told Kilgallen that she was attending Hollywood parties hosted by the Inner Circle among Hollywood's elite and was becoming the talk of the town again. Rosberg indicated in so many words that she had secrets to tell, no doubt arising from her trysts with the president and the attorney general. That, of course, is Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. One such secret mentions the visit by the president at a secret air base for the purpose of inspecting things from outer space. Kilgallen replied that she knew what might be the source of the visit. In the mid-50s, Kilgallen learned of a secret effort by U.S. and U.K. governments to identify the origins of crashed spacecraft and dead bodies from a British government official. Kilgallen believed the story may have come from the New Mexico story in the late 40s. Kilgallen said that if the story is true, it would cause terrible embarrassment for Jack and his plans to have NASA put men on the moon. And then the document goes on to talk about some specific things about the diary. They're afraid that there might have been references to the secret plan to kill Castro and so forth. And the document is signed by James Angleton, who at the time was the chief of counterintelligence for the CIA. But see, that line, of course, that's what caused all the furor, you know, this line that says one of the diary secrets that everybody was kind of nervous about was, and it actually literally says, the visit by the president at a secret air base for the purpose of inspecting things from outer space.
Hmm.
That's pretty suggestive, I'd say.
Yes. And for those who don't know, Dorothy Kilgallen was a columnist.
Yeah. At the time of her death, which was a few years later and equally mysterious with Marilyn, she was actually working on a book on the Jack Kennedy assassination. And the night she died, the notes for that book disappeared. And actually, a friend of hers had looked through the manuscript, or at least as much of it as she had completed at the time, and had said there was material about the Kennedys in there that was explosive and spectacular, and he used, you know, words like that. And so actually, there's just another facet of the mystery. Apparently, there was some stuff about to come out there that somebody couldn't allow to be released.
Dorothy Kilgallen had actually written several articles on UFOs in the course of her career before she mysteriously suicided.
Yeah, so what the CIA document says there about her having talked to a UK government official, we think that that was actually Lord Mountbatten, and that he had actually told her some things that were pretty amazing about UFO secrecy, you know, that were common knowledge to the UK and US government.
Lord Mountbatten was Prince Philip's uncle, the husband of the Queen of England.
Yeah. And that information comes, you know, from pretty lofty sources.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently, it was kind of the same problem with Dorothy. She was sitting on stuff that basically somebody decided just couldn't be allowed to see the light of day. What I basically do in the book, toward the end of the book, is I really talk about how painted into a corner, you know, the Kennedys must have felt, especially Bobby, by the fact that they had sort of alienated Marilyn at that point. They were beginning to distance themselves from her, basically because J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI had pretty much demanded that the president do that. He actually told Jack, you know, you're a security risk, hanging around with her and talking about this stuff to her and everything. So drop her, push her away, cut off her special phone line, and you guys don't have anything to do with her anymore. And so they were doing that. And, of course, she was royally ticked off, you know. And the fact that she was talking about having a news conference in which she was going to, quote, tell all, and that actually is mentioned also in the CIA memo, and the fact that maybe it just might be too late. They waited through that weekend and maybe saw her do that on Monday. The expression tell all probably took all kinds of significance in Bobby Kennedy's mind and Jack's mind beyond anything that the words would normally suggest. Because if she did know about a UFO crash retrieval and she did tell it, the situation would have become intolerable for everybody. Because remember, in the summer of 1962, we were just about an inch away from global war. We were going through this whole thing about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Soviet Union and all the missile and saber rattling, and we were just on the brink of war, at least we thought we were. If it came out right then that Jack Kennedy had told someone not authorized to receive classified information in a time of war or near war, he could have been indicted for treason. That's about as nasty as it gets, you know.
Yes, yes.
And I can just see Bobby Kennedy. See, Bobby went over to Marilyn's house the afternoon of the evening she ended up dead, and he basically tried to get the diary from her. And he kept on screaming and screaming, saying, I'll pay you for it, my family will pay you for it. And she basically just threw him out of the house. He went over to Peter Lawford's beach house just a few miles away in Santa Monica and saw things over, and I can just kind of see, I kind of go through this in the book. I sort of go through what he must have thought, because it's not that hard to figure out. He must have thought, okay, I expected her to be a good little girl and just give me the diary, you know, and promise not to have anything more to do with me or my brother, and just to kind of like not hold any press conferences and just all around behave herself. And she's obviously not inclined to do that. In fact, she is so unspeakably furious at this point that she may not even wait until Monday to have that news conference, and heaven only knows what she's going to talk about.
Yeah.
And so I think he figured, okay, if she does this, if she tells the big one, then the presidency is going to go down because Jack will be indicted for treason. I can just see Bobby think, I'm the attorney general. Actually, my department, the Department of Justice, would have to actually do the indictment. I'll have to step aside, hire a special prosecutor. See, here's the nasty thing about that. Can you imagine going to war? It would have been with Lyndon Johnson as president. Cipher, that moron. I don't think anybody wanted to see that happen. Because Johnson couldn't have handled it. I think everybody knows that. There's no way in the world he could have handled that. Look at the way Vietnam went with him. Of course, he was only at the beginning of Vietnam, but he was basically not a sufficiently effective president to stand up under something like global war. If Jack had been indicted for treason and had gone down and basically had lost the presidency, in order for the Justice Department to prosecute that case, in effect, at least in the public perception, they would have had to admit that what Marilyn had said at the news conference was true, right? How can you look at the logic? How can you basically indict somebody for imparting classified information illegally if there's no such information?
Mm-hmm.
What that would have said to everybody is, hey, they really are hiding UFO debris and alien bodies, and Marilyn really did know about it, and Jack really did tell her about it, and that's what this whole thing is about. And see, I think, you know, Bobby Kennedy was unprincipled. He was a loathsome person. But the one thing he was not was stupid. And I can just see him running through this whole scenario in his head over there at the beach house that afternoon and thinking, well, you know, what it really comes down to is it's too late to handle it any other way. Marilyn's going to have to be taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really look at things, people say, well, Bobby Kennedy, he was the darling of the college crowd, you know, when he was running for president and everything. See, they weren't old enough to remember, but I was, that he was a special prosecutor during the McCarthy era. They didn't know that, but I did. Obviously, Jack Kennedy had all this charisma and everything. The guy was a jerk. He was a womanizer. He was a blabbermouth. He was a security risk. When FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, he told him, Jack, you know, you've really got to shape up because you're a security risk at this point. You know what? I never really liked Hoover that much, but Hoover was right, because Marilyn was not the first and Marilyn was not the last. Jack had dated a woman suspected of being a Nazi spy when he was in naval intelligence.
Oh,
that was before Marilyn. After Marilyn, Jack had actually dated a woman with whom he used to do drugs up in the White House, and he used to get so stoned he didn't even know where he was half the time. People have this image of Jack, and it's just not true. And I think Marilyn is the capstone, the proof in fact that Jack Kennedy was a whole different kind of guy than people think. But let me tell you what I discovered about the Marilyn memo. I had it up on the computer screen one day in my lab at the college here, there was a young lady working in my lab. Her name was Jane Shoemaker, a student worker there. And she was kind of looking over my shoulder at the document, and she pointed to a place near the top of the document on the left side and said, doesn't there look like there's kind of a shadow there, you know, like something might have been typed there. Ted, I hadn't noticed that, frankly, and I looked at it and said, Jay, you don't think you're right. One of my specialties is computer image enhancement. And so all I had to do was kind of a simulated ultraviolet wash on that, you know, and kind of run it through some software, and actually I was able to bring out what that smudge or that dark place actually was, and that was typed. It was apparently either a show-through from photocopying or from scanning or something of the sort. And it was basically electronic bleed-through of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. And what it said was, it was a reference to the name Brigadier General Shulgin.
Oh, we've heard that name before.
Yeah, that's why when I saw it, I literally fell off my chair on the floor. I just couldn't believe what I was looking at. Because General George Shulgin was, in 1947, at the time of the Roswell incident, was the chief of the Air Intelligence Requirements Division for the Army Air Corps. So later, of course, later in that year, rolled over into the Air Force, and when they became the Air Force as a separate branch, his job just rolled over with similar titles, similar duties, and basically what he was the chief UFO investigator for the Air Force at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind, the United States Air Force has never had any UFO investigators. But what I'm saying is, of all the ones they never had, he was the chief one.
And they never had a blue book either.
No. And here I was looking at this name on the top of the Marilyn Monroe CIA memo.
Wow.
Okay? And basically, at the very least, what that means is that somebody, for some logical reason, had those documents archived together. So if that doesn't make a link between Marilyn and the whole UFO question, I don't think anything could.
It becomes increasingly apparent that Marilyn Monroe wasn't offed because of her knowledge about the potential attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Yeah. Yeah, they were nervous about a number of things, actually, she might have known about. But, you know, the interesting thing is, really only one of those things that she potentially knew about was long-lived enough to account for everything that we now know. In 1983, the Maryland biographer Anthony Summers actually interviewed a chap named Jose Bolaños. Bolaños was a Mexican screenwriter and movie director and producer, and they had had a kind of a romance. Maryland used to go to Mexico and shop and hobnob with some people that she knew down there, mm-hmm. and that, by the way, made the government kind of nervous because a lot of these guys were left-wing types, and of course that made them nervous. Marilyn had met Jose Bolaños down there, and he really was so smitten with her that he followed her back to the States. He actually followed her back to Los Angeles and kind of hung around. And the night Marilyn died, Bolaños called her on the phone, as nearly as I can tell, about half an hour before she died. And they talked, and then apparently there was some kind of commotion at the door, and Marilyn put the phone down and never came back. Later, when Anthony Summers interviewed Jose Bolaños, he said that Bolaños had told him, when he talked to Marilyn just before she died, she told him something, and this was his exact word, she said, she told me something that will one day shock the whole world. And that was his verb tense, will one day shock the whole world. Now, this is in 1983.
Mm.
By 1983, the other matters that are mentioned in the CIA document, Marilyn knowing about the secret bases in Cuba and the Jack Kennedy plan to assassinate Castro, all that stuff was declassified by then. Certainly, you can't explain it by saying, well, what was going to be so shocking was that, like, Marilyn had had affairs with the Kennedys and so forth, and everybody knew that by then. The wives knew it even at the time that it was going on. And really, when you make a list of what could it have been that Jose Bolaños had heard from her that he thought appropriate to describe by saying in 1983, this is something that will one day shock the whole world, something that had not come out yet, something that was classified in 1962 and in 1983 was still classified, and in fact in the year 2007 is still classified. My list comes up pretty short.
Yeah.
I think Bolaños could have only been talking about one thing, which is why when I asked the CIA for those wiretap transcripts, they'd rather die than give them to me. They really would, because they know perfectly well how spectacular those transcripts have to be.
Is Jose Bolaños still with us?
No. Jose Bolaños died in 1994, June 11th, 1994.
Dern.
He was only 58 years old. He died in Mexico City. I have not been able to find out the cause of death.
Hmm.
I looked for him for a long time. When I finally caught up with him, he was dead. Unfortunately, I didn't get to interview him again.
Would Jaime Masson down there be able to help you with autopsy results, if indeed there was an autopsy?
That's conceivable. I should probably ask him.
Mm-hmm.
I've never actually had any direct dealings with him, but I should probably ask him that. He might be able to find out.
Yeah, he's a very helpful guy. I've had him on the program several times, of course, you know, on various topics.
Right.
And events down there in Mexico.
Yeah. The interesting thing about the UFO field in Mexico is that the Mexican government doesn't have any real axe to grind about it. Everything mm-hmm. is a great deal more open there.
Yes.
When they had the Campeche incident where these Mexican pilots who were doing the runs, you know, checking, you know, watching
drug interdiction.
Drug
yeah.
planes. You know,
yes.
You know about that event.
Oh, yes. We had Jaime Masson on the program. Actually, John Velez, who's a regular contributor to this program,
yeah.
translated the
right.
recordings.
He
yeah.
said there were so many objects on the screen, and
mm-hmm.
kept counting 11 on the screen.
And then there was that mysterious airline pilot who popped up on my UFO updates list
yeah.
and suggested that it was the oil field flares. He pops up every 3 or 4 years and literally dumps all over anything big that's coming out of Mexico.
Yeah. Well, I've seen the Campeche film.
I have a copy of it here, the DVD.
I have a copy of it, too. I know what flares look like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they said the Phoenix lights were flares.
Yeah, but these were flares, burn-off from oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah. The fact that they were actually making a trajectory across the sky, I suppose, doesn't...
And you look at the instrument readings that are on the video, and you see that the plane is flying straight and level.
Yeah.
And not down on one side or the other.
Exactly.
Which would be the only way that they would have visual contact with those
exactly.
things.
Exactly. And again, the interesting thing is that these were photos that, had they been taken in the United States, would never have been released. If Campeche had happened in Kansas, we'd never know about it.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, never, ever.
Brazil is loosening up. France has loosened up. Ministry of Defense in the UK has loosened up of late.
Yeah.
All that remains is for the Americans, who were the initial cover-uppers.
Yeah, you would think that, I don't know if they ever played follow the leader as a children, but you would think that at some point they would be so ashamed that they weren't opening up about it when so many other governments are opening up. I guess I'm pretty cynical about our leadership sometimes. I told you that, first of all, Jack Kennedy was a terrible president in some ways because he's a blabbermouth. It wasn't safe to have him as president. Johnson, what can I say? I guess the last president I've actually admired was probably Thomas Jefferson.
I didn't realize you were around back then.
Yeah, I'm not quite that old, but by all accounts, they don't make them like him anymore. But Jose Bolaños actually, I think, is a real clincher. The very fact that he put it the way he did when Anthony Summers interviewed him means that even 21 years later, not only was he obviously talking about something that was still classified, because he said, you know, this will one day shock the whole world if it comes out, but he showed, of course, that he remembered verbatim a telephone conversation 2 decades earlier. How many of us can remember word for word a telephone conversation we had 21 years ago?
Not many of us.
Yeah. So evidently whatever Marilyn said to him was spectacular. And there are other indications, too. One of the last people to talk to her was Sidney Gilaroff, who was a hairdresser, actually, for the movies. He worked for 20th Century Fox. And you see him actually listed in the credits for many, many, many movies, you know, having done the hair. He actually did Marilyn's hair for most of her films. And later he told an interviewer that when he last talked to her that night, she told him some secrets about the Kennedys. And when the interviewer said, what kind of secrets, all he said was, very dangerous ones. And he just let it go with that. He wouldn't elaborate on it. And by the way, when Anthony Summers was talking to Jose Bolaños about this, and Jose Bolaños said, Marilyn told me something that will one day shock the whole world, naturally Summers asked him, well, what was it? And he said, I'm afraid to talk about it.
It's a pity he didn't, because it would seem that he was probably offed as well.
Yeah. And the thing is, they did talk about it, obviously, on the phone, which is why those wiretap transcripts have got to be released someday. That is going to be so spectacular. if we ever can find out exactly what those transcripts say. I pretty well know what they say. A lot of the time we operate in this field of UFO studies on the basis that we sort of know what's going on, but it's just a question of finding strong enough evidence for it. A lot of us are beginning to take the attitude that it's really questionable how important the cover-up is, because we pretty well know what was going on anyway.
Yes.
We know what happened to Roswell. We have 300 witnesses. Why shouldn't we know? Yeah. We've got 3,000 witness interviews.
And Kecksburg is the same.
Yeah.
Although there are the Don Eckers of the world that will tell you that the reason that it was hushed up was because it was Soviet technology that fell out of the sky.
Yeah.
And there was this deal between the Soviets and the United States to hand back any such technology that happened to fall out of the sky
right. On
one another's property.
Yeah. Somebody told me that to this day, half of Kecksburg doesn't speak to the other half.
That was very evident in the thing that Sci-Fi Channel
did on
Kecksburg. They were equally divided down the middle.
Yeah. There's a certain amount of that with regard to the Roswell incident, too. You still have people who say, nah, it's all nonsense, nothing happened here, it's all just conspiracy theory. But when you've actually talked to as many witnesses as we have, you've actually seen the kind of coherent picture that comes out of it. It doesn't leave, well, my friend Kevin Randall is fond of saying, if we were to take all this to court, we'd win.
Oh, yeah. People have been convicted on less circumstantial evidence.
People have been sent to the gas chamber
exactly.
On less evidence than this.
So Dorothy Kilgallen supposedly committed suicide. There were barbiturates or some sort of drug found in a glass that didn't match what was in her system.
Right. It's just Marilyn all over again, because the night Marilyn died, there was a lot of people going out of their way to make a point of the barbiturate pills and bottles and everything, you know, all over the place. There are some problems, of course, with that, too. Similarly, there was no glass. Something a lot of people don't know about Marilyn is she had a lot of trouble swallowing pills. Bob Slater said she had trouble taking an aspirin unless she had a great big glass of water. And let me tell you a little about the blood chemistry thing, because actually Donald Wolf actually dug most of this out, and it's very, very convincing as far as the suicide thing goes. And I've seen the suicide thing repeated. Time magazine, you know, 2 years ago said Marilyn had committed suicide. Just absolutely not true. Unimaginable. Not even conceivable at this point. Because we have her toxicology report. Most of the autopsy report actually disappeared because the coroner had it removed. But the toxicology report that Dr. Abernathy did stayed on file at the Los Angeles Hall of Records and pretty much intact. And it's one of the most disturbing things you can ever look at. The night she died, analysis of her blood showed that her blood contained 4.5 milligrams per cent of pentobarbital and 8.0 milligrams per cent chloral hydrate, in other words, 8.0 milligrams per 100 milliliters of blood volume. Any toxicologist will tell you that combination would kill anywhere from a dozen to 15 or 20 people. She had some really, really nasty stuff in her blood. Now, if you ask the Abbott Laboratory people who make Nimbutal, which was the pill that she would have gotten the pentobarbital from, how many pills would you have to take to do that to yourself, to bring your blood toxicity up to that level? They'll tell you anywhere from around 90 to around 110.
Holy cow.
Tablets.
Oh, my.
When you ask them, could you take 90 to 110 Nimbutal tablets, they'll just laugh at you and they'll say, well, you know what? You sit down and start gobbling those pills, taking Nimbutal, what's going to happen is after you get about, maybe 25 or 30 of them down, you're going to have a hard time swallowing the rest of them because you're going to be dead. Pentobarbital is a respiratory depressant that keeps you from breathing. And you'd be lying on the floor with your eyes glazed over by the time you got to the 30th pill.
Oh, my.
There's no way in the world you can swallow 90 to 110 Nimbutal tablets and take chloral hydrate on top of it. I mean, the whole thing is inconceivable.
Without a glass of something to wash it down.
Yeah, with no water. And by the way, the water was turned off in the bathroom, off of her bedroom that night for repairs. There's no way she could even get a glass of water. They were doing repairs on her plumbing at her house. So, essentially, there's one way you can bring your blood toxicity to that level that quickly, and that's by injection. The night she died, Elizabeth Pollard, who lived next door, was playing bridge with her friends. They always did that Saturday night. And she saw Bobby Kennedy walk right by the window, headed into Marilyn's place with two guys. One of the guys was carrying a little black bag, like a medical bag. That was a little after 10 o'clock. And later, Norman Jeffries, who was the caretaker there, said that Eunice Murray, who was the maid around the place, but actually Dr. Greenson, her psychiatrist, had placed Eunice in the house to keep an eye on Marilyn, we think. And when Bobby and the two guys came in, they told Eunice and her son-in-law, Norman, to get out of the house. They said, just go somewhere and stay there. We need to see Marilyn by ourselves. And so what Norman and Eunice did was they went next door, and they just kind of hung around watching out the kitchen window, and around about 35, 40 minutes after 10, here came Bobby and the two guys out the door and around the corner and down the street and gone. And when they walked back over to Marilyn's house, the door was open to the guest cottage. The dog was barking, and Marilyn was stretched across the daybed, just about blue-black at that point from anoxia, and very quickly dying. And, of course, Bobby had been there just seconds before that.
For the second time that day.
Exactly. Only this time he made it the last time. So it's an ugly story.
It really is an ugly story, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. When you think about the motivations and the thought processes, when you think about the fact that Bobby Kennedy was the kind of guy that if you painted him into a corner, which I'm sure he felt had been done to him that afternoon after the argument with Marilyn, his solution was just to take down a wall to get out of the room. And I'm sure that he mulled it all over pretty carefully and pretty logically and just came to the conclusion that the only way in the world the government was going to survive, keep the presidency intact, keep the government strong, you know, going to war with the Soviet Union, if that's what it came to, and so on, was to take Marilyn out. It's one thing to have the public told Jack and Bobby have been sleeping with me. Everybody knew that. Their wives knew that. Jackie knew it. Ethel knew it. It's another thing to say to the public, we've been hiding UFO wreckage and bodies for several years now, and we've lied to you about everything imaginable, but vote for us anyway. They couldn't let that happen.
And she'd already talked to Dorothy Kilgallen, who had made copious notes.
The tragedy is, if Marilyn had just had the news conference, instead of talking about it on the phone, she could have walked down to the corner of Hollywood and Vine and just snapped her fingers, and there would have been reporters around her, you know, like fleas on a dog. If she had just done that, everything would have been different. But unfortunately, she talked about planning to do it. You couldn't even walk into her house without tripping over wire, I think. I mean, everybody in the world had her phone tapped, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why I've rejected the alternative hypothesis. The mafia didn't take her out because the mafia wanted her alive. The mafia people had their own wiretaps there because they were trying to get some dirt on Bobby Kennedy. And when Marilyn died, they lost all of that. All the wiring came out of the house. She was gone.
It's actually amazing that she could hear anything, the number of taps on her phone.
And the terrible thing is that Marilyn knew it. She knew that her phone was tapped. So you think that she would have thought, maybe I better not say anything about the news conferences given that this is my phone, but evidently she just didn't knit that together in her head. One time, Bob Slater called her and wanted to talk about something, and she said, I tell you what, Bob, I'm going to drive down the road and pick up another phone and call you back because my phone is not secure. She knew that. She knew that her phone was tapped.
Yeah.
I don't think Marilyn really believed that they would do anything like that.
Well,
I mean,
she was Marilyn
Monroe. Bobby had come over that afternoon, and they had a big fight, and he had slapped her around, and you could hear on the surveillance tape Peter Lawford trying to calm him down, saying, come on, Bobby, come on, cut it out. But I think Marilyn really didn't believe that they'd go that far. I think she didn't believe they'd kill her. And when anybody says to me, oh, well, you know, you conspiracy theory guys, you're nuts thinking that government would kill somebody to keep UFO stuff secret. And, well, no, we're not, because they would. They have done it. They have killed people to keep it secret. They just picked on the wrong lady this time. It's one thing to just blow somebody away who's an unknown, but if they really thought they were going to get away with this forever, I'm sorry, forever's a long time.
It'll be interesting to see what transpires in the next few years as far as that whole episode of ufology is concerned.
Yeah, now we've got, as you say, the Ministry of Defense in England is talking about releasing a lot of information. The Brazilian Air Force has already done it. Several other governments, Mexico, Belgium, have been very open. It should be interesting to see if this government ever really decides. You know, there's been talk, you probably know that Jimmy Carter, you know, when he was campaigning for president, said that he was going to declassify all the UFO stuff, and of course, after he got in,
he supposedly sent Daniel Sheehan to the new National Archives library to dig out what he could. Daniel Sheehan, the wunderkind lawyer from the days of the Nixon debacle.
Right.
I had Danny Sheehan on this program few years ago now, and she described getting into the archive and not being able to take anything in with him except pad and paper, guards on the doors. And he said that he had seen all kinds of pictures, imagery of downed objects with dead bodies around, presumably were taken at Roswell.
I would imagine that after Jimmy Carter was actually in office, probably all it took to dissuade him from his campaign promise about declassifying everything was just having somebody sidle up to him and say, hey, remember JFK?
Yeah.
Do we have to say anything more, you know, to make
no,
the point? You know,
not at all. You're not about to stick your neck out too far after that, are you?
Well, no, not if basically they give you to understand that that you're expendable. Even the president, people think it's such a lofty office. But, you know, this whole thing, when you look at the way classified information works, the clearance and the need to know, I'm sure there are presidents that have been told they have no need to know.
Absolutely.
One time, Bill Clinton was asked point blank, when are you going to tell us the truth about UFOs? His response was, when they tell me. And, you know, I'm inclined to take that remark seriously.
Yes.
It's a terrible thing because there's a certain kind of snowball rolling down a hill, kind of momentum, to the telling of lies. Sometimes the longer you tell them, the more you feel you have to keep telling them. And I think that's kind of where they find themselves. I really think that a lot of government agencies at this point would like to just let us figure it out for ourselves, because we are doing it. And obviously, they don't really mind so much that we're doing it, because if they did, we'd all be dead.
Yes, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation.
Exactly. So I think they're largely taking the attitude, well, you know what, let's just let these guys figure it out, and let's just keep saying no comment and try to come away as unsullied as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not do it by an act of disclosure ourselves.
Well, it wasn't them. It was way back, and all they've done is keep it up.
Yeah, exactly.
As you said, need to know. There are probably very, very few Americans who know what the truth is.
Oh, I'm sure.
Hard and fast fact. Because all of that information is bound to be compartmentalized.
Yeah.
And there's probably maybe the number of digits that I have on my right hand who actually really know what has transpired.
When I was in the Air Force, I was actually in Air Force intelligence myself. I had a top secret clearance. And one place where I worked, somebody pointed to a door one day and said, don't ever go in there. I was kind of new. I said, well, I've got the clearance. I said, it doesn't matter. You don't have the need to know what's in there.
Yeah.
And that's the way that works. And I'm sure the President of the United States has been told the same thing at times.
Absolutely, especially after the experience with Jack Kennedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Very interesting, Don Burleson. I really look forward to reading your book. Is it actually out there now?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to do was mention my publisher's website so that people can get the book if they're interested. The book is published by Black Mesa Press, which is mostly a mail order company, and the website, you can just go to blackmesapress.com. It's just blackmesapress.com, all written together. The book and some others, you know, are available there.
Yes.
And you can use PayPal or send in an order or whatever, you know. The books can be ordered there for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I will do is I will put up a link in the program listings to blackmesapress.com.
Great.
We have spent an hour together, and we haven't gotten through a tiny fraction of the things that I would like to have gotten into with you. I know you haven't had your your dinner yet, so...
Right. Well, I've enjoyed it.
It's always a joy to hear myself saying, wow! I've gotten a little jaded over the last few years.
Is that what you mean?
Don Burleson, thank you, sir. It's been good. Lots of luck with the book. I think the more people read it, the more they will become convinced that there has been something going on, that the United States government, the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA all know about.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
My thanks to Dave Verlott, Mike Woods, and Don Burleson for adding to our knowledge. In the next cast, Stuart Miller, David Rudiak, and Alfred Lember. More strangeness still. Till the next one you listen to, bye.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.